started with us.
This training will be taught by Althea Billings, the news director, and myself, Tammy Hepteus, the public affairs director. The training will take place at KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Ave. Hope to see you there.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next on Art Focus, Kristen Derryberry covers The Unknown Artist by Lucy Cotter, now showing at the 511 building of the Arlene and Harold Schnitzer Center for Art and Design, now through April 18th. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from PDX Pendables, stage and studio supplies. PDX Pendables sells and rents to film and theater production, from gel and globes to paint and lights, featuring the latest Airy LED lighting. More information is available at 503-887-5880 and pdxpendables.com.
Andy Warhol looks a scream, and him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
I'll edit. Hi, you are listening to KBOO Portland. I am Kristen Derryberry, and this week's guest host for Art Focus. Today, we are talking to Lucy Cotter, the curator for the show Unknown Artist, up now until April 18th at 511 Gallery at Pacific Northwest College of Art, Center for Contemporary Art and Culture. Hi.
Hi, Kristen. Lovely to be here.
It's nice to have you. During the crazy week of opening and a bunch of events that are coming up too, and that I thought was really awesome that you're engaging the audience with multiple different activities that are happening throughout the opening and during while the show's up. So yeah, I would like to first talk about the beginning stages of like the concept of the show and the choice of space behind that.
Well, the title of the show is The Unknown Artist, and it looks at different kind of questions like what is the importance of making, who makes things, and how do we see the relationship between made objects, artworks, and so on. And one of the reasons for asking this question is to think about the future of art, the sustainability of what we're doing, and thinking a lot about also this landscape in Portland, but also globally, I would say. I'm Irish, and I've lived long-term in Amsterdam before I moved here a year and a half ago. And I'm thinking a lot about what's the future landscape of art and culture. So how I came to this space and the concept. So I was thinking a lot about this kind of, you know, time of change that we're in, also a political climate where contemporary art is not necessarily supported. And I've seen in the European landscape the closure of a lot of institutions and the retraction of arts funding, and also the threat of retraction for contemporary arts funding in particular. And I've thought a lot about solidarity, actually, how people working across the arts can support each other, and maybe how we need to reimagine the field so that it can actually be more sustainable, and at the same time also a more equitable place, so that we take also questions of cultural representation and visibility on board, you know, with those questions about a more sustainable future. And when I moved to Portland a little bit over a year and a half ago, I was, you know, trying to get to know the local kind of art landscape. I think I was at the TBA Festival when I met Mark McFarland, who's the director of the Center for Contemporary Art and Culture. You know, he asked me to meet and, you know, get to know each other. And so I became aware of the Center for Contemporary Art and Culture. I had been there to see a show a couple of years earlier and also, you know, seen a few shows there. But preparing to meet him, I noticed that this space had a collection. I hadn't noticed that. I just saw it as another contemporary art space. And they are actually custodians of the collection from the Museum of Contemporary Craft, which started out as the Oregon Ceramic Studio in 1937 and ran under different titles, existed in Portland until 2016. So I immediately thought about this, you know, closure in relation to those bigger questions. And that also really led me into how rich Oregon is actually as a place of making, how it is. And, you know, who are the people, who are the circles of people who have fueled that, you know, from the 30s to the present. And when I looked up the collection, I was really intrigued to see some works by potters that I've been fascinated for years. One of them is the Japanese potter Shoji Hamada. Another is the British potter Bernard Leach and Janet Darnell Leach, who later married Bernard Leach. And they're connected to a movement that I was very, very interested in, especially as a young artist, a young art student in the early 90s. That's called the Mingai Folk Art Movement. And one of the pioneers of that movement was a Japanese Uetsuya, and called The Unknown Craftsman, which collects his writings, thinking about craft. In the 1920s and 30s, when Japan had industrialized and there was a threat of craft basically disappearing by not really valuing the work of ordinary makers, but makers who have acquired skill over many years, and a kind of a making tradition that's passed on, the making of everyday items. And through industrialization, you know, these things were disappearing, and he realized, okay, because the identity of the makers is not known, they don't have a value. And the Mingai folk art movement that he kind of was largely responsible for prompting revolved around his ideas and these potters whose work are in the Museum of Contemporary Craft collection, Shoji Hamada and Bernard Leach. So for me, seeing those in the collection was a beautiful kind of reunion with ideas that I've been busy with maybe 25 years ago, and then suddenly coming full circle with my current questions about sustainability of art and the place of art, you know, in society now and in the future. So I thought it would be very beautiful to bring, you know, that kind of time of crisis then together with some of the questions of now. And then at the same time, I noticed that in the collection, the Museum of Contemporary Craft collection, there are 1,300 objects, but it includes a small collection, about 72 objects, whose histories have been lost. And I was quite intrigued by this. And I thought, okay, how do you value an object or an art object whose history has been lost? And I thought, you know, the kind of vulnerability of these pieces and the invisibility of these pieces also links up with this kind of threat of obsolescence of art itself and also the disappearance of institutions. So I decided to create a show which would bring together these works that are very rarely seen, with works by contemporary artists that are asking questions around the value of making, around lost histories, and also around, you know, what the artist or the craftsperson or the maker can mean now, also into the future. For example, one of the works in the show is by an artist called Chanupa Hanska Luger, an indigenous artist who invites people, you know, all over the world to contribute through social collaboration to make objects that will support activist goals. So I'm thinking also, what is the future of making and what place does it have?
Yeah, wow. That was a wonderful explanation, and also how engaging that is for the audience to come in with those false, unknown histories or false histories even. Are there any ways in which, like, you are seeing the audience engage with this work in surprising ways?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, one of the things which I hoped through this show is that, you know, I must say I believe really strongly in the relationship between kind of artistic discourses and wider cultural, social and political discourses, as well as being trained as an artist. I later did a PhD in cultural analysis to actually look across those relationships. And I think that I hope that this question, you know, makes people think also about this region and this landscape, and the value of what's happening here, and maybe imagine what could happen, what needs to happen. I'm also interested in this show being a kind of vehicle to remember some of those lost histories of makers in this region. For example, there's a very beautiful figured piece in the show as a constructivist figure, a very imposing, quite large ceramic figurative work. And, you know, no one knows who's made it. And when I have done quite some research in the museum archives, you know, and there are proposals for, you know, a series of different artists who might have made it. And each of those artists are very successful and known nationally and internationally in their own right as well. So one wonders, you know, how this history can disappear. And I hoped that through this show that, you know, certain histories might be pieced back mm-hmm. together. That's one thing. And another thing is that I hope through the show that certain conversations would happen about, you know, kind of solidarity and the future of the landscape in this region. And I will do two lecture performances connected to the show. The first one is called The Unknown Future, where I will, you know, use a format, something between a lecture and a performance, to kind of weave together questions coming from the idea of the unknown craftsman into thinking about this moment and thinking about sustainability. And I hope that after that, you know, performance, that certain conversations will take place in that space. Another event connected to the show will be an extension of another project by the artist Chinupa Hanske-Luger, where the public will be invited to make handmade clay beads for a project called Something to Hold On To. This is a project where the artist is trying to make artifacts that will visualize statistics that are kind of unfathomable. So for this project, he is asking people to make more than 7,500 clay beads
wow.
to represent yeah. The number of people that have lost their lives on the U.S.-Mexican border.
That's very impactful. It gives it more of a visual impact of what is happening now with old craft of making beads as well.
Exactly.
It makes it very nonlinear.
And I think that, you know, I mean, I want people, you know, who don't make, to actually make at that moment and through that context to actually think about, you know, the value of made things, actually the impact and the presence mm-hmm. that they have in the world. There will also be a performance by Takahiro Yamamoto called Property of Opaqueness. And this is a dance-based performance. He will perform with two other dancers. And it's a piece that really looks at how we validate the performer through looking. And I think another question in this show is really, where does the identity come in? How much do we need that? How much weight do we put on it? And as you're well aware, Kristen, I mean, this is also a time in art discourse where a lot of things revolve around identity.
Mm-hmm.
But certain identities have a currency. They're also put in, slotted into certain positions. And I'm interested in complicating those narratives, you know, really weaving in what's the relationship between personal biographies, you know, actual individual trajectories that move across different locations and cultures and times, and what gets edited out to make these kind of clean histories.
Mm-hmm.
Also the relationship between the potter Bernard Leach and the Japanese potter Shoji Hamada that I mentioned earlier is a very kind of iconic East-West dialogue. They toured the US in the 50s and, you know, lectured at places like Black Mountain College and were very connected to the kind of revival of the American craft movement. But their relationship and the kind of trajectories are much more complicated than that. And I think we constantly edit these stories, and these kind of behind-the-scenes interweavings of histories bring us to a kind of constellation that is much closer to acknowledging the complexity of how we live right now in society with each other, where
mm-hmm.
cultures and histories are always intermingling, you know, and always have been.
Always evolving.
Yeah.
And changing.
There has been a moment of people mm-hmm. turning up and complexity suddenly being added. And I think if we can acknowledge more of these kind of complexities long term, we have more sensitivity to ways to actually address the present, not as separate issues, but as a kind of continuity across, you know, different areas.
Precisely. That was very well spoken on something on linearity in history and what gets told. But we're going to take a pause, and I just want you guys to know that you are listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Kristen Derryberry, and this week's guest host for Art Focus. Today, we are talking to Lucy Cotter, the curator for the show Unknown Artist, up now until April 18th at 511 Gallery at Pacific Northwest College of Art, Center for Contemporary Art and Culture. I would like to take from that discussion on non-linearity and histories and telling to talk about the layout of the show. I found it to be surprising and unconventional, using the first piece as when you step in, you see all these traditionally rendered pieces with very
paintings.
Yeah, with paintings, and the frames are, some of them are broken, and then some of them are pristine. They look old. There is an age to them. Just want to talk about that as like an introduction to the rest of the layout space.
So that first piece is a mixed media installation by the Hungarian artist Zsolt Asztalos. He's based in Budapest. He's very well known in his own country. He's represented Hungary at the Venice Biennial, among other kind of accolades. And this is his first time showing in the US, so it's quite a privilege to have that work here. That work is part of a series called Unknown Artists, which I came across through researching this show.
And it was wonderful. It's a happy surprise.
To connect up with him. And he spent 4 years basically looking into the history of forgotten artists in Hungarian art history. And I think one of the interesting things I find about his practice is that he shows us both that art history is as much a process of forgetting as it is of remembering. And also that artworks quite easily slip into just being objects, and they need a lot of care to actually continue to exist. And that piece draws attention to the fate of, I would even say, the majority of artworks in museums, which is that they spend most of their life in storage.
Mm-hmm.
Some pieces never come out, and certainly if a piece is if the artist behind a piece is not known or recorded, chances are that work is going to be stored permanently.
It's hard to come to grips with that reality as an artist myself, and going to school for art, and that's what we're told. And so it's nice to see a show that is highlighting this reality.
Yes. So, I mean, for me, I think it highlights also the vulnerability of art. Like, we can have an arrogance. Those of us who work in the art world, we see the value of art. We care about art. But in fact, as the resources also continue to diminish, you know, I have seen also in the Netherlands, for example, the quick deaccessioning of collections that have taken hundreds of years to put together. You know, and this is kind of the reality of our times. But also, I'm interested in the labor around art. There is, you mentioned the installation. When you walk in the door, you see these kind of, you know, paintings which are like from the 17th and 18th century. They're like kind of old master paintings. And it's a reproduction of those works kind of piled against the wall. But there's also like some cut off boards and bubble wrap. And it looks a bit like the show is still in installation. And then there's a second piece by him, which is basically metal storage shelves with other pictures on them.
I saw that.
Items.
It made me very curious.
So I have specifically placed that other work next to the objects from the Museum of Contemporary Craft. And I thought that if I displayed those objects kind of on pedestals, they appear to be kind of secure and in a good position where they're being valued and shown. But the reality is, you know, they're more or less permanently stored objects, and their future really relies on a certain kind of care, which is not guaranteed at all, actually, because it takes a lot of resources. And I wanted to juxtapose those pieces because it casts a different light on the Museum of Contemporary Craft pieces. And on the other hand, I'm also interested in how Zolt's piece and also another video work in the show, A Dissonance of Landscapes, which is by a Korean artist based in the Netherlands called Aram Lee. Her video takes some pieces from 10 paintings from a storeroom of a kind of tropical museum, which is basically a colonial collection in the Netherlands, takes them out of the basement, literally, and brings them, into light, literally, probably for the first time since they've been stored. They're paintings by Chinese painters from the 1800s, but they're winter landscapes. They're in a Dutch style. They're painted for the Dutch market. And they're this strange kind of painting that doesn't belong to one culture or another. They're beautifully painted, but yet they were kind of objects for sale. So they're kind of in between objects. And they show also all these histories that, you know, don't reach the history books. A certain kind of production of paintings, let's say. But combined, they interrupt this kind of preciousness of paintings. And also, when you look at the objects from the Museum of Contemporary Craft collection, you'll see that I've juxtaposed, for example, a pre-Columbian with the constructivist figure that I mentioned earlier, or basket, which is from the Noop tribe in Nigeria, juxtaposed with a modernist clay piece from the 50s from this region.
And you're also juxtaposing those objects with video that is often seen as unjust.
Also, there is also another video which I think we should mention, which is a piece called 75 Watt, which is by two artists, Revital Cohen and Tour van Balen. They're based in London. They started out as industrial designers, and they're very interested in those kind of production processes. And the work in the show by them shows these Chinese workers in the region of China where these kind of made-in-China objects are produced on a conveyor belt, basically, you know, fabricating, assembling plastic objects. But their movements are choreographed, and it becomes almost a dance. And for that work, you know, they were interested in how the workers' bodies, the movements of the workers' bodies, do these kind of repetitious movements for many months in response to object specifications. And they reversed that process, and they basically designed an object that would produce certain movements. So we see the workers producing a useless object, which is also maybe an artwork, to create a sequence of movements. And, you know, if you look at the show as a whole, you get this kind of strange constellation that you don't normally see across different kind of makings. Making which is normally seen as mass production, making that's seen as craft, making that's seen as art. You see making that is for commercial purposes, artistic purposes, you know, all kind of mixed up together, also for social activist purposes, all kind of mixed up together to ask questions about what are the continuities across these things and how can we reimagine these relationships? Because obviously there's a lot of protectionism around different areas. What is craft? What is art? What is design? You know, what is being fabricated? What is being produced? What is being produced for an artist? Which museums do these things belong in? But actually, I think in the current landscape, it's also important to acknowledge a certain kind of material intelligence and aesthetic, you know, awareness, the role of people who understand those different materials and competences, making as a form of thinking, regardless of what context it is. And how can we articulate the value of those things? Because from the ground up, the whole cultural landscape is changing, and the resources and questions around representation and public access and accessibility, they're changing, they're putting pressure on things from the top down. And at a certain point, I think there's an interesting meeting point between what's happening from the ground up and the top down. And I think it's driven as well by the urgency of changing resources. And I think it's a beautiful time. I think it's a time of asking ourselves where the value lies. Who is it for? Why are we doing things? How can we imagine also the arts in a way that is more meaningful for the people that work in the arts, and in a way that's meaningful for society? And how can we allow the structures to become more fluid, rather than each kind of trying to protect their own little corner? That we can talk together across these things and raise really fundamental questions, which is why I go back to Suetsu Yanagi and this book, The Unknown Craftsman, because it's very deep questions around value.
Yeah. Wow, thank you. I would like to talk about, you mentioned the upcoming events. I would like to give our audience some dates and times. So the lecture performance by you, Lucy Cotter, that's going to be on March 12th, which is a Thursday. It's going to be at PNCA at 7 p.m. It will be in the auditorium, which is in the Media Tech. And then there's going to be Property of Opaqueness, which is a performance by one of the artists that is showcased in the show. And that's going to be on March 19th, also in the Media Tech at 7 p.m. Something to Hold On To, which is a social collaboration workshop in conjunction with Kanupa Hanska Luger. And that's going to be on March 18th. And that's going to be in the atrium foyer, so it'll be kind of in the middle hallway and the main area at PNCA. That's going to be March 18th from 12 to 4 p.m. And then After Difference, which is another lecture performance by Lucy Cotter, and that's going to be on April 9th at 7 p.m. in the auditorium as well.
And I should just add that all of those events are described on the PNCA website. You can
yes.
just go on to PNCA events and you'll see all of them.
Yes, and they're all free. And that's amazing.
And well, I just want to mention, just didn't mention one other artist in the show is mm-hmm. Mamie Takahashi, who's a Tokyo-born artist based in Portland. And I think there's a very beautiful series of photographs by her in the show, documenting a performance that she did here in Portland, really looking at questions of visibility of herself and the experience of what it is to be an artist and a Japanese woman living in the U.S.
Wow, thank you. That was a really good send-off. Well, thank you, everyone. And this has been Art Focus. You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Andy Warhol looks a scream. Hang him on now. Whoa. Andy Warhol, silver stream. Can't tell them apart at all.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Feet to Fire campaign and protest on Friday, March 20th from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. at the Multnomah County Courthouse in Portland. The Feet to Fire campaign is part of a national campaign started by Protect Our Stolen Treasures out of Detroit. This peaceful protest happens every month outside of a different county courthouse and calls for justice for those lost to police violence and hate crimes, particularly those who were in a mental health crisis when they were killed by police. Again, that's Feet to the Fire campaign and protest on Friday, March 20th, from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. at the Multnomah County Courthouse, 1021 Southwest 4th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process.
Nevada does not predict South Carolina, but Nevada sends us a signal similar to South Carolina sending a signal about Latino and African American voters and the degree to which they are rallying behind one particular candidate.
University of South Carolina professor Todd Shaw on the role of this Saturday's South Carolina primaries, but tonight's the 10th Democratic debate in Charleston. And what was once the most diverse primary debate stage has narrowed to an all-white, majority male group with just two women. All six candidates from last week's debate, plus businessman Tom Steyer. Former Vice President Joe Biden leads South Carolina polls, despite Senator Bernie Sanders pulling ahead as the national frontrunner. House Majority Whip Jim Clyburn, a key South Carolina Democrat, reportedly plans to endorse Biden tomorrow. Here's Shaw again.
We have a fairly diverse divide, if you will, between black elected leaders as to who to stand behind. And it seems as though Steyer has made some real movement in the polls. So even though 2 months ago, Joe Biden was solidly in the lead in terms of African-American support.
Tonight's debate is not only the last one before South Carolina's primaries, but also the last one before Super Tuesday, a week from today. Los Angeles alone has more people than voted in the first three states combined. California, with its 494 delegates, has around 5 million Democratic voters. Bay Area journalist Phil Traunstein says voting on Super Tuesday earlier than previous years makes a difference to some Californians.
When these tiny little states have such outsized influence, that's very frustrating to folks in California. So I think people feel good about the fact that their vote may count.
Ordained minister Dallas Conyers from South Carolina thinks the primary process in the early states is too protracted.
It does skew people and who they would vote for in the primary, because now they're not voting so much for who they think is going to be the best presidential candidate. More and more people are voting along the lines of, well, this is the person that could win and we don't want the party split.
Overall, Traunstein thinks California is more moderate than many people expect.
I think that Bernie Sanders sort of has a lock on the left liberal wing of the Democratic Party. But this is really a moderate state. And if you had one leading moderate candidate against Bernie Sanders, I think that moderate candidate would probably win.
Sanders does lead in California polls, but Senator Elizabeth Warren, Biden, former Mayor Mike Bloomberg, and Buttigieg are all fighting for that second spot, and all hoping to stall Sanders' momentum by launching sharp attacks at him. Meanwhile, President Trump's on a 2-day visit to India. He joined Indian Prime Minister Narendra